Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriel Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott.
Hi.
Estelle Cuevas loves her pets, two cats and six dogs.
This is Oreo. He's a West Corgi. That's Papa, baby, mama. Yeah, Papa, how are you? Yeah, Papa don't have a tail.
Estelle lives in Mariana, a tiny mountain community in eastern Puerto Rico. And on September 20th of last year, her pets were her main concern as she was getting ready for the big storm she knew was coming.
My husband and I took all the dogs and cats and brought them in with us. We were sure they were shelter right, and they all had their cages with the covers.
They hunkered down, and then Maria hit.
It was like somebody pounding. I mean, constantly a pound. But it was like one after another. And you could hear the cracking of the trees and the wind gust.
Water started coming into their home through the windows and doors. She peeked out of one of her windows.
Seeing my dog shed flow away, and that was shocking. And I was like, the dog shed, you know, that's their home.
The next morning, Estelle tried to brace herself for the damage she would find.
I remember when I opened the blind in the morning, I couldn't cry. My heart hurt, but I couldn't cry. It was like, oh my God, it was like something came and burned it.
Hurricane Maria destroyed lives and communities, homes and landscapes. It devastated the island's infrastructure, which has had lasting consequences. On this episode of The Pulse, we'll explore what's happened in the years since the storm, how people and places have adjusted, adapted, and recovered. The biggest issue that complicated every aspect of recovery on the island has been Puerto Rico's power grid. It was wiped out during the storm. For example, in Estelle's community, it took 9 months to get power back. The grid was not in great shape before the storm hit. The system has to traverse mountains, it's aging, and financial problems have crippled upkeep in recent decades. But there's another factor causing problems: trees. Transmission lines, the high-voltage cables that carry electricity over large distances, are supposed to be kept absolutely clear of vegetation. But in Puerto Rico, that's not the case. Irina Zhurov takes us to the island.
Hurricane Maria brought power lines down throughout Puerto Rico. 9 months later, Julio Alvarado Feliciano was still working hard to restore them.
We're here in the Tanama neighborhood. We're raising this line that's on the ground.
Julio is a technician with the island's power utility, PREPA. He's based in the north central municipality of Arecibo. The day before, his team reinstalled fallen utility poles and unspooled fresh cable on the ground between them. Now, they're trying to raise the lines from the ground.
We're going little by little by little, raising them, raising.
But it's complicated here. It's remote. More than that, it's overgrown. Much of the damage to local lines was caused by trees falling and blowing into them. Where a cleared right-of-way should run under the transmission lines, grows a beautiful orange orchard.
Lots of people plant trees, like the guama, guaragua. These type of trees around here grow fast and get into the lines.
The trees aren't always planted. Sometimes it's just wild growth.
Brando!
Julio calls down a ravine to another guy somewhere in the brush.
Brando!
Brando Cuadro stumbles up the steep hill. When he joins us, he's sweaty and out of breath. He had just walked along the cable, untangling the brand new lines from the orange trees. At the utility pole, another guy cranked the line tighter, raising it. In other places, workers use helicopters to hang the cables, so the lines never touch the ground. But there are no helicopters here, no trimmed right-of-ways. Just untangle, crank, untangle, crank. Little by little by little. When Puerto Rico started building its power grid in the 1940s, about 6% of the island was forested. Today, more than half of the island is covered by forests taking over abandoned agricultural lands. And that forest, it's lusty. It grows fast, 12 months a year. So when Hurricane Maria came through, it wasn't just that the infrastructure was old and poorly maintained. It's that one of the most complicated pieces of technology, the power grid, is no match for a tree. I spoke to the people at PREPA. Maria Rodriguez in the utility's fiscal office says vegetation was a problem even before the storm.
We tend to have many outages vegetation related.
Nearly half of all power outages stem from line contact with greenery. Because the mountainous terrain and long growing season make maintenance difficult, Maria doesn't think Puerto Rico can ever have manicured right-of-ways like those on the mainland. But she says the utility can do better. It must.
We are trying to avoid to get to a similar situation with a future storm.
In terms of kind of the changes at PREPA right now, because there's a lot happening, where does this rank in priority?
Number one.
Oh, really? Why is this number one?
Because it's a reliability issue.
Thing is, the utility is in serious financial trouble. After years of mismanagement, it's about $9 billion in debt. For years, it's been cutting spending and staff. As people quit or retire, they're not replaced. PREPA used to have dedicated vegetation management crews. Today, they're mostly gone. The utility wants to outsource the work. About 30% of the total maintenance budget will go towards vegetation management efforts. Problem is, there's no established outside industry to do that work on the island. Meanwhile, what employees remain are doing the best they can. Even in urbanized spaces, nature asserts herself. I meet another utility worker, Alexi Hernandez, at the main entrance to the town of Utuado. His team has blocked a busy bridge in with their trucks to get to a big tree that grows on the riverbank. The power lines that bring the community electricity disappear into the tree branches.
A branch fell on the lines and made contact with the lines. And when that happened, well, it made an explosion. This all happened this morning.
Alexi is on the utility crew that's fixing the lines and restoring the town's power. They cut away two of the fallen branches, but others remain stretching over the lines. Alexi says environmental regulations only let him cut what's absolutely necessary to make the current fix.
It's a ceiba tree, one of the oldest trees here in Puerto Rico. It's 50 or 75 years old. These trees are protected by the government.
He says Puerto Ricans love their trees, but he adds the remaining branches will likely break at some point too.
Unfortunately, it will happen again.
But for now, it's lunchtime. In a little restaurant nearby, over rice and beans with chicken, Alexi says this region used to have 60, 70 employees. Now, if 15 show up, it's a lot. He's a heavy equipment operator, but finds himself clearing vegetation.
We have more work and fewer employees.
And there will be one less soon. He's already put in his retirement notice.
I should have been gone already, but I haven't been able to because of the emergency. As soon as they let me, I'm going. 30 years, it's enough already.
Then he starts to reminisce about all he's seen in his 30 years working on the power lines. There are the pretty views from mountaintops. There are the mudslides that take down lines and poles. They send infrastructure tumbling, as if a tablecloth pulled out from under a set table. He remembers coming across this crazy thing that kind of epitomized the utility's challenge with nature. A yagramo tree, an early settler in New Forest, had grown around a utility pole. It had swallowed it.
Se hicieron uno solo. Parecía una sola pieza.
They became one. It seemed like just one unit. We left it alone and put up another utility pole. We left it. Didn't touch it.
That time, they let nature win.
That's Irina Zhurov reporting, and we'll hear more of her stories later on. When the electric grid goes down, it has a powerful domino effect that reaches every aspect of our lives. Phone and data antennas need power, so when the lights went out after Hurricane Maria, 95% of cell sites did too. 911 service did stay online because of the backup system they had in place, so the few people whose phones still functioned after the storm were trying to call for help. Ruth Silver works for 911 in Puerto Rico, and she remembers one desperate call that came in from a family that had not evacuated.
They were already on top of kitchen cabinets, and they said that the water was running into the house like in a river. And they needed to get out.
But the thing is, 911 dispatchers couldn't send help. They couldn't reach anybody. Firefighters, paramedics, police, their phones were dead. Ruth says the 911 dispatchers felt despondent.
Some of them were just, they couldn't handle it. They will just take their headsets off and start crying and give it to a supervisor.
Once the storm passed, telecommunications stayed quiet. People had no way of communicating what they needed. Nobody could reach family members and friends to tell them they were okay. Estelle Cuevas, who we heard from earlier, was desperate to get in touch with her daughter on the mainland.
No telephone. It was dead. It was like, you couldn't get any reception and call somebody and tell them or send them an email or YouTube. Nothing.
And people outside the island were trying to reach their loved ones there, anxious to hear if everything was okay. One of them was writer Sierra Ortiz Blanes. She's a recent college grad. She's from Guaynabo in Puerto Rico, a city near San Juan. She lives in Philadelphia and was 1,500 miles away from her family as the storm rolled in. At first, her mother was still messaging her.
20th of September. Hurricane Maria. It's 6:08 in the morning, and we're not in the worst part of the storm yet. However, it's raining extremely hard. It's raining so hard that it looks like a snowstorm amongst the palm trees.
As the storm made landfall and I slept, my mother, Mariana, sent me videos like this one. She knows that soon, Puerto Rico will be cut off from the world. So every 30 minutes, she records a new video on her phone. In the background, the radio buzzes until all the stations go out.
This is an experience that puts you in your place within the grand scheme of things. We are a little ant facing an unstoppable force.
In one of the last video messages, it sounds like the wind might shatter her bedroom window. I can hear my father telling Mama to be careful, to get away. As she runs from the shaking glass, she drops the phone to the ground. Around 7:30 that morning, the messages stop coming. Instead of hearing from family, I'm constantly checking the national and international news for updates. The destruction of places I know is all over my social media feeds. Water, rushing down the street where my childhood ballet studio is located. A park near my school looks like a graveyard of palm trees. In Philadelphia, during my lunch break, I sit on church steps near my office, furiously trying to get in touch with my family. No answer. There are gurgling sounds instead of rings. It's like Maria is drowning the phone lines. Back at work, I try to focus, but all I can do is scroll through the devastation that pops up on my computer. I'm searching for any detail that's reported. Suddenly, an image on Facebook sends shivers down my spine. It's Dorado, the coastal town where my grandparents live. Videos load on my screen. The stores and restaurants we regularly go to have water up to the roofs. I have no way to know if my abuelos are safe. Jacobo, my abuelo, is 78. My abuela is 76. She and I share the name Sira, a name we both got from her mother. They're alone in their home. I know they at least have protective metal hurricane shutters and a strong house, but I worry about the fury of a Category 5 storm. And I am angry. I'm in complete disbelief they are riding out the storm alone, instead of somewhere safer with my mother and father. Eventually, an informal communication network starts to grow on social media. Tweets, posts, relayed messages, information starts to get to me in Pennsylvania. When Mama and I do connect, we speak on borrowed time. She's using the cell phone of a kind stranger she met on the street, one of the lucky few with coverage and battery. In Doralo, Iram, a man I've never met who lives near my abuelos, plods through the devastated landscape to check in on neighbors. On his satellite phone, he texts updates to his sister, Tatiana, who lives in Miami. Then, Tatiana posts her conversations with her brother on Facebook. Iram visits my grandparents and lets Tatiana know, Jacobo Muria, familia, también. Jacobo Ortiz Murias, family are okay. When I do hear my grandparents' voices for the first time, it's 3 weeks later.
Hola, sí, aquí me entró una llamada tuya, pero me dijeron que te dejaron mensaje. Pues el mensaje es que te quiero mucho, abuela.
Over time, there are more ways to get in touch with my family. I send them batteries, walkie-talkies, flashlights. They send me stories of waiting in line for gasoline for hours, and of living with no power. I hear about their worries about not having enough water. Nearly a year later, Puerto Rico is slowly healing. My family has found a new normal, like the fridge in the middle of the living room that runs on solar power. Every time I return to visit, there are fewer broken traffic lights and more electric lines and blooming trees. It's been hard being so far from home during the recovery, a home so in need. But now, my family is just a call or a text away. Today, I cherish it every time the phone rings.
That's Sierra Ortiz Blanes. She is a recent college grad. She lives in Philadelphia. Her family lives in Puerto Rico. So many people were affected by this breakdown of communications, and the Telecommunications Regulatory Board in Puerto Rico is taking steps to make the system more resilient during a future storm. They've buried miles of fiber optic cable around the perimeter of the island instead of hanging it on poles. That makes the system more resilient to wind and tower movement. Providers also have generators for their towers, and first responders will have access to satellite phones during emergencies. The Federal Communications Commission has promised up to $750 million for Puerto Rico to rebuild and update its systems. The loss of power after the storm wrecked the island's health system. Modern healthcare doesn't function without electricity, and there was no real emergency plan in place. Patients' lives were at risk. Reporter Emily Cureton caught up with Roxanne Vasquez, a mom desperate to find care for her son Jacob, who was born prematurely.
When Jacob was born, he weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces. His story begins in Puerto Rico, just 3 months before Hurricane Maria.
Jacob was born in a hospital in Ponce. After that, the first hours, they told us, you know, the NICU that we have here, it's not the level that Jacob needs. We're not used to this kind of baby so small. So we need to transfer him to another hospital.
Jacob ended up on the top floor of the pediatric hospital at Centro Medico in San Juan. Then Hurricane Maria shredded the roof.
The light went off in the hospital while we were there. And the generator took 43 seconds to turn on. Because I count them. I was nervous. I was like, why is it taking so long? My baby depends on full life support.
Roxanne says conditions at the hospital got worse. Jacob and the other babies were moved to another floor. Mold crept into the building and into Jacob's ventilator line.
I was like, no, I know it's not happening. I asked the baby's dad. I was like, can I get a wipe? So he gave me a wipe. I cleaned it in the outside. It wasn't in the outside. It was in the inside.
For some perspective, I looked into what happened with hospitals after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. At one comparable to Centro Medico, all of the patients were evacuated to Atlanta, and the facility never reopened. The head of Global Environmental Health Sciences at Tulane University told me that's because once it grows, toxic mold will always come back. In Puerto Rico after Maria, many of the small hospitals closed, but the one where Jacob was stayed open. Because there's nowhere else to go. That's despite indoor mold levels across the city more than doubling.
And I was like, if Jacob stays here, he's not gonna make it.
Baby Jacob went from Puerto Rico to Georgia, and now he's at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. The family is hoping to take Jacob home soon. They live in Texas now. Many Puerto Ricans with health issues were in dire situations after the storm, with no power to run medical machines, no place to get or refrigerate medications. I talked about this with Omaya Sosa Pascal. She is the co-founder of the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico. They've been interviewing families and digging into health records and emergency preparedness plans to find out exactly what happened in the island's hospitals after the storm.
Well, they were totally overwhelmed. In the end, the biggest hospitals, we have 68, were also without power, but all the patients that go to all the levels of the system ended up in these hospitals that had generators, as they are supposed to have, right? But in a matter of days, the generators had no diesel, they were not working, so they also lost their emergency power. And many of the hospitals were really struggling to try and just offer basic services.
And it also sounded like hospitals were just completely overwhelmed with the number of patients. People were on stretchers and hallways.
All the patients ended up in the hospitals, even though they were not necessarily emergencies. So, for example, oxygen-dependent patients, people that are dependent on oxygen and otherwise are fine. The provider was not distributing oxygen to the homes, for example, the weeks after. The people didn't have electricity in their homes, so they all ended up in the lobby of the hospitals asking for services in hospitals that were already struggling just to serve the most critical patients. So it was a very, very difficult situation that did not last days. This lasted months, at least 2 months.
We've been hearing different numbers about the death toll that was the result of Maria specifically. What can we know about the death toll when the hospitals were in such bad shape, and what role did the healthcare play in the high death toll?
Well, up to now, in the investigations we've done, we've found out that over 60% of the persons that their family members say their death was related to the hurricane or to the emergency, the aftermath of the hurricane included, died in a healthcare facility. That we know from our investigations, right? What the final responsibility and numbers are, we don't know. The Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico had to sue the government to get mortality data. So we finally won our lawsuit. And as you may imagine, that's a lot of documentation. We're talking about around 23,000 deaths that have occurred. Those obviously all don't have to do with the emergency. But now it's the job of our team to go through all that information, try to sort it out. What we were seeing in our initial investigations, that most of the deaths have to do with problems with electricity and communications, and many have to do with the lack of healthcare services in some kind of way.
What is the state of Puerto Rico's hospitals now, and have some of the clinics reopened?
Yes, most hospitals are working and are working kind of business as usual as they were before the hurricane. But as we say in our story, they were already somewhat in bad shape before the hurricane struck in terms of their finances. So, they're hanging in there. But I believe another natural disaster would end up in a similar or worse situation. The Department of Health has not corrected the situations that were happening and that caused all these problems in the first place. There's still no plan, no public healthcare plan to react to an emergency. The situation would be worse if another hurricane of that magnitude strikes tomorrow.
What are people saying about this? I mean, people must be mad. So is there a public outcry? Are people demanding that a plan be put in place so that hospitals are better prepared next time?
People are very disappointed. People are angry. But they have so many problems, and this is just one more of them, you know? I think people are very worried because of the healthcare situation. That's one of the biggest worries. But right now here, the unemployment is soaring. I mean, people are just, many people are looking after their day-to-day basic needs and thinking about if they leave Puerto Rico to get a job or if they stay, or if they leave right now to get healthcare because they can't find a specialist here. It's an ongoing situation, and people just, I think, they don't know what to do. They've lost all confidence in our government, in Puerto Rican government. They've lost total confidence in the federal government too. And I think they feel abandoned, totally abandoned.
That's Amaya Sosa Pascal. She is the co-founder of the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about Puerto Rico 1 year after Hurricane Maria hit the island. The storm tore up a lot of farms. It destroyed 80% of crops and caused $1.8 billion of damage to agricultural infrastructure. Estelle Cuevas, who we met earlier, says in her mountain community, people quickly became used to food shortages.
I don't know if you've ever seen Walking Dead. They go looking for what they need to survive, and that's how it felt here for a while. You heard somebody's giving food up there in La Loma de Mariana, well, you run, or you get somebody to take you to pick up some food and water.
Since the storm, some farmers have been trying to rebuild and replant their land with a renewed focus on sustainable agriculture. They see it as a more independent way to grow food, and they're hoping it might make their land more resilient in coming hurricane seasons. Paige Flager reports from Ay Bonito, Puerto Rico.
High in the mountains of Puerto Rico, farmers drive their pickaxes deep into the earth. They struggle to keep their balance on the sloping hills of the guava orchard as they dig a trench a few feet wide to help retain rainwater and reduce erosion. It's called a swale, and it's a method of sustainable farming that's especially useful on steep land like this 7-acre farm.
In Puerto Rico, that's the reality of most sustainable farmers because the best farmlands are in hands of the biotech seed companies like Monsanto and Bayer.
Daniela Rodriguez Pesosa is a farmer in Ay Bonito. She's part of a group called the Circuito Agroecológico Ay Boniteño. They're all farmers, mostly women, and they spend 1 day a week at each other's farms. They've been working together since the hurricane to clean up and help each other become more sustainable.
I mean, Maria hit, and it was an eye-opener for a lot of people, and it was also a call to action. Like, nobody else is going to help us. We need to help ourselves. And how do we help each other?
She says these farmers have come to see sustainability as synonymous with resilience and independence. They hope that if they only rely on themselves, they'll be better prepared for the next hurricane season. Or at least they'll be able to recover on their own terms without waiting for help. There's science to back up that sentiment. When researchers studied farm damage after extreme weather events like hurricanes, they found that diversified small farms suffer less damage than large farms that practice monocropping.
It's kind of like the classic don't put all your eggs in one basket.
If a farm only grows one crop and that crop is destroyed, there's nothing left. But if a farm has lots of different crops, some may be destroyed, but others, like root vegetables, may survive the storm.
Mi nombre es Jessica Collazo, y mi finca es en Ay Bonito, Finca Escondida.
Jessica Collazo's farm is a few miles away, on a small plot of land carved into the mountainside. A couple of baby chicks and a few thin beds of fruits and vegetables line the plateau, which drops off and disappears as if swallowed by the valley below. She has a panoramic view of paradise, but after the hurricane, things weren't so serene.
After Maria, we were left with nothing. We had to start over from zero.
The storm washed her crops, her seeds, and her soil over the side of the mountain. She and her husband make their living and support their daughters by selling their produce at local markets, but they were left with nothing. The brigade of farmers helped build banks on the edges of the mountain and dug swales in hopes that it would lessen the damage of the next hurricane season. They helped her get new seeds so she could replant, and just last week, they came to clear fallen trees from part of her farm. But she fears she still hasn't done enough if there's another hurricane this year. The farm isn't even fully recovered from Maria yet.
If this year, 2018, a hurricane comes, the same thing is going to happen to us.
Jessica practiced some forms of sustainable agriculture before the hurricane, but that didn't protect her from the wrath of Maria. She hopes that working with her fellow farmers will help her make her goal of becoming completely sustainable sooner than she could have on her own. That way, she'd have the independence to recover from the next hurricane on her own terms.
For example, for me, for my sustainable farm, I want to have my own well for water. I don't want to depend on the government, or in this case, on Puerto Rico's aqueduct. I want to have my solar panels. I don't want to depend on electricity.
Small farmers face especially tough obstacles as they recover from storms. Large farms can rely on governmental aid and crop insurance to help them recover, but small ones don't qualify. The way crop insurance is set up now, farmers need to have at least 1 acre of one type of crop.
We learned that after the hurricane that we need to start asking them special insurance conditions to Puerto Rico.
Carlos Flores Ortega is Puerto Rico's agriculture secretary. He says he's in touch with the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture to review insurance policies for the growing number of sustainable farms on the island.
There is a wave of new generation of people asking for fresh, more organic, and more healthy products in Puerto Rico. So these millennial generations, they are getting good impact in the agriculture as well as the woman farmers.
He hopes this influx will help solve a problem that became particularly apparent in the wake of the hurricane. Puerto Rico imports more than 85% of all of its food, which makes it really difficult to find fresh, healthy food on the island, especially during a natural disaster.
Right after the hurricane up here in the mountains, there was like a severe food crisis. There was no food, and people were standing in 4-hour-long lines just to get bags of crap.
Sitting in the shade of a tree on her farm in Ay Bonito, Daniela Rodriguez Bezosa explains that despite the losses they endured during Maria, they had things that many of their neighbors lacked. Thanks to solar power, they had electricity. Thanks to their rain catchment system, they had water. And thanks to their diverse crops, they still had some fresh food.
We felt like the richest people in the world. To actually have greens on our plate was like such a luxury.
That's part of the reason she's turned her farm into an emergency resilience hub for her community. She'll be able to offer nutritious food and water. Neighbors can plug in their medical devices, and fellow farmers can put their crops in cold storage so they won't perish. That way, when the next hurricane comes, she'll be ready to share the wealth from farming sustainably. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
Coming up, can you protect a house built on an eroding beach?
He's trying to bring some rocks here, gathering them, and putting them up against the house.
Rebuilding in places that are disappearing, still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriel Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriel.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about life in Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria. People have left the island in droves. Estelle Cuevas, who lives in eastern Puerto Rico near where the hurricane first hit, says sometimes she feels alone.
It's been different. A lot of people have moved, like all these people here moved. That house right there. I thought I was going to have neighbors, but she's planning to leave to the States. People are just evacuating. They're leaving.
Many people felt like they had no choice. Belinda Pastrana had been a chemistry professor at the University of Puerto Rico for 2 decades when Hurricane Maria hit. She spent her career researching proteins that are used in medications for illnesses like Parkinson's or cancer, and she had started a promising company. I first talked to her last November. She told me about the days and weeks after the storm. She had hunkered down at home, but as soon as she was able to, she went to check on her lab. There, she found a major mess. All of her backup power systems had failed.
So we lost all reagents that had to be refrigerated or frozen, $250,000 worth of reagents that were very unique because they were designed and built in and made in our lab.
How many hours, days, years of work was that?
20 years.
Belinda knew she had to move forward after the storm. Her startup needed a new home if she was going to keep working on the proteins she was developing. Nearly a year later, we checked in with her. She has relocated her company to Boston, but she's been back to Puerto Rico several times since.
There's still problems with the electricity. There are still problems in terms of shipment of large goods to the island and from the island. And the situation is still very, very fragile.
And what's the university like? How many people have left? Who's teaching classes?
Surprisingly, a lot of the faculty members that were nearing their date of retirement have retired. Positions are left vacant, and there's just a higher burden on the faculty members that have stayed.
When you talk to people who are still in Puerto Rico, what sense do you get? Are they hopeful that things are coming back together? Are they ready to jump ship?
Many are still leaving, and still a large portion of the young population is willing to stay to try to rebuild. But it will take time.
Belinda thinks it's important to support existing medical technology companies that remain in Puerto Rico. The island is one of the biggest manufacturers of pharmaceuticals in the world. But looking back, she says leaving was the right call for her.
We had to move fast. We had to try to make do with what we had at the moment. And I am very much thankful for the support of NSF, the National Science Foundation, and all of the scientists in the community that allowed us to be able to make this move and this transition as fast as possible. In our case, time was of the essence. There was considerable losses, but I could not think of them at the time. I just had to move.
After big storms, with all of their destruction, some people will choose to leave, and those who stay will start to rebuild. But rebuilding can be complicated in Puerto Rico. The storm eroded the island's beaches, which means any structures built on them will be more vulnerable during future storms. Irina Zhuroff visited one community reckoning with the implications of that.
Rosa Elena Mastache Dominguez is 54 and comes from a family of fishermen. Some 4 generations back, her ancestors claimed a little piece of beach on the north central coast of Puerto Rico. They built a house on the black speckled sand, looking out onto palms and blue-green water.
My grandparents grew up here. My grandparents raised my parents here, and my parents raised us.
The tight-knit community, now known as La Boca, has a deep sense of place. And it was shocking when, in September, Hurricane Maria struck.
The area has completely changed.
The storm eroded about 90% of the wide beach where her family home sits. Waves clawed at the flat expanse of sand, replacing all but a strip of it with encroaching water. It wasn't just that the familiar landscape disappeared. It left La Boca defenseless, says geologist Maritza Barreto.
The beach works as a buffer of all the energy from the swells and the storm waves.
Then came a second punch to the already weakened community. In February, a cold front brought huge waves. Without the beach to protect them, Rosa Elena Mastachi Dominguez, she goes by Rosie, and her neighbors watched nervously.
We were watching and waiting and thinking, the sea always comes up to there. It won't get to us. Oh, the sea always gets to there. It won't get to us. We never thought the sea would reach us. Never.
But it did. Rosie leads me up to the house. Her parents slowly built up the wooden home into a cement structure with several bedrooms and bathrooms. Clothes hang on a line and the driveway is neatly swept. But when the door gives, the smell of Clorox mixed with ocean greets us in an empty home. A deep crack runs up one wall and down the next.
The sea split the house in half.
Where the entire back of the house used to be, there's nothing. The waves battered the house and scooped sand from underneath it until whole rooms collapsed. The family moved out March 1st and put up a metal sheet to close the gaping hole. The neighbors pulled their money to buy a pile of rocks. As we talk, a worker riding a small machine with a claw is reinforcing the foundation of the house.
He's trying to bring some rocks here, gathering them, and putting them up against the house.
The man maneuvers between slabs of cement jutting out at odd angles from the sand. Just beyond, a full bathroom, walls and all, lies down beach from the house it tumbled from. Six houses and a handful of businesses were damaged in La Boca, but that repeats all over the island. Even before Hurricane Maria, more than half of Puerto Rico's beaches were experiencing erosion. It's caused by sea level rise and coastal construction, which disrupts natural cycles of sand movement. In other words, building on the beach weakens the beach. That's a problem when nearly everyone lives along the coasts.
Most of the economic activity of Puerto Rico occurs also in the coastal areas, mostly in the San Juan metropolitan area.
This is Ernesto Diaz. He's director of the Puerto Rico Coastal Zone Management Program. He says all the electric power generation is also located along the coast.
You have a sanitary infrastructure, you have power transmission lines, fiber optic cables.
Ernesto says erosion is a natural process, and so is sea level rise. But human actions have sped those things up.
If sea level rise is increasing and at an accelerated pace, and we're losing beaches also at an accelerated pace, and we humans made ourselves vulnerable by building so close to the coastline, obviously what were formerly natural processes are now social problem.
Today, Puerto Rico has laws that prohibit construction on the beaches. Some developers still manage to do it. But perhaps the bigger issue is that many of the structures on Puerto Rico's coasts were built before the laws passed. Take Rosie in La Boca. Her family has changed the house, updated it, but they've been in pretty much the same place for something like 100 years. As these beachside properties succumb to storms, climate change, or just time, people are not supposed to rebuild what was there. I tell Ernesto how the community is already investing in rebuilding, and he sits up straight.
If people are dumping rocks to protect properties as we speak, they are doing so illegally.
Rosie knows all this, but she says the government hasn't told them to stop rebuilding. Enforcement is notoriously lax. No one has stopped them, and no one is helping them to relocate either. The cold front that damaged homes in La Boca is not a federally declared disaster. So people here don't qualify for the federal emergency money that other families got after Hurricane Maria. Rosie says without aid, many in her low-income community don't have the option of moving.
If the government comes and says, you have to leave and here's this much money for you to get out, that's one thing. But if they don't tell you anything, you have to fix what you have.
She also knows there's a good chance that the house, even if it is rebuilt, will be wrecked again by the sea. I ask her if living here seems sustainable.
No. No.
And yet, she says the affected families all want to return. Before we leave the house, Rosie points to a handwritten Bible passage she tacked up on the mint green wall outside.
Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away.
As she locks up the front door, another door that once led to a bedroom flies open. Through the doorway, we can see the ocean waves break in the near distance.
That's Irina Zhurov, and her reporting in Puerto Rico was made possible with support from the Society for Environmental Journalists. What do people need in times of crisis? A hero.
My name is Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez. I'm the writer and creator of Labor en Kenya.
Labor en Kenya is the name of Puerto Rico's anthem, but Edgardo is referring to a new superhero he has created. She's the star of a graphic novel he's written.
Labor en Kenya is Marisol Rios de la Luz. She's an undergraduate student at Columbia University studying earth and environmental studies.
Marisol gains her superpowers during a study abroad trip to Puerto Rico, and Edgardo's book touches on issues like climate change, tropical storms, and the island's debt crisis. But this superhero is also very much a regular person.
What do you like best about her character? What are your favorite qualities?
I love that she loves food. I love that she loves to dance. I don't think that we don't actually see superheroes being human enough in stories. You know, they don't eat, they don't dance, they don't share time with their family. They're busy punching villains through walls.
Even though Edgardo created the character before Maria hit the island, Labor en Kenya has become a symbol of post-storm recovery and resilience.
Everything that I write is infused with optimism, because the hero always wins in the end. No matter what injustices, no matter what conflicts the character goes through, they always overcome. And I believe introducing a character like Labor en Kenya is an affirmation of the resilience of Puerto Rico. I was in Puerto Rico just this past May, and as I walked the island, as I drove through the island, I saw the resilience of my people. I saw them rebuilding roads. I saw them replanting palm tree seedlings. I saw them working alongside one another. They continue to rise up, and they continue to help one another.
Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez is the creator of Labor en Kenya. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tong. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.